The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to do some walking, so get your shoes on. We're going to begin on a Japanese peninsula, where writer and photographer Craig Maad takes us on a long walk in a fading corner of Japan. Now, his article appeared in the New York Times ongoing series, The World Through a Lens. It appeared in the April 25th, 2022 issue of the New York Times. And so as we do this walking, we're going to first get a brief introduction from the editors to explain, and they make a statement about their travel series. At the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, and this was back in 2021, with travel restrictions in place worldwide, we launched a new series, The World Through a Lens, in which photojournalists help transport you virtually to some of our planet's most compelling places. And this week, as they wrote in this time, Craig Maad shares a collection of images from Japan's main island, Honshu. Now here's his story. Stand on the summit of Mount Hinodegate. Look inland across the Kii Peninsula, and there before you are 1,000 peaks, crumpled earth like tinfoil, frozen royal to the horizon, razorback edges of rock and soil, all muted tones. Turn toward the ocean, and you'll see the jagged coast wrapping from the port of Nagoya Town and around back up Osaka Bay, shaped by what's called the Kurashio, or Black Current. The Kii Peninsula, the largest peninsula on Honshu, the main island of Japan, is perhaps best known for a series of pilgrimage routes that link three sacred sites, Hoshino and Omine and Kumano Sasan and Koesan, to the ancient cities of Nara and Kyoto. Before the Nanki train lines were blasted from the mountains and the lonely National Route 42 was carved out alongside the coast, these highlighted paths were in active use. People young and old would walk and haul their goods, stopping at a tea house at the top of a pass for some yamogi mochi or mugwort rice cakes, or maybe a few dango rice balls slathered with soy sauce and grilled over charcoal. And if not walking, then people could use boats to ply the coastal waters. Sailing from cove to cove must have been a wondrous experience 200 years ago. Imagine being young and in love with someone from Hatasu and maneuvering with the tide, meeting on sandy beaches, placing your feet together in the Kukai Springs. Well, once, according to an ancient folk song memorialized on a stone monument in the city of Owas, a boatless carpenter fell in love with a girl from the town of Mikasoto on the far side of a mountain range. He sang, "If I had my way, I would flatten that mountain Yakiyama with a hoe and allow her to pass." Well, today, a train ride of just a few minutes could carry him through the mountain to true love. I was first invited to visit the Kii Peninsula 12 years ago to spend a few days in Koryasan, a mountaintop city whose main Shingon Buddhism temple, Kangobuji, dates to A.D. 816. Now, the fertility of the area astounded me. Those trees, the graveyard is home to not only to the remains of many lords from Japan's turbulent Sengoku or Warring States period, but also to moss lush enough to lie down on. I moved to Japan for college when I was 19 and have lived here for most of the last 22 years. The town in America where I was raised, from which I immigrated, was mostly tobacco and blueberry fields, its ground infused with farming and industrial poisons, leading to rumors of uncommonly high rates of dementia and violent impulses. Who knows what's in my blood? But after 3 days spent up in those Koryasan temples, I felt my body change in the way that pure nature changes bodies, the fresh inputs of mountain water and mountain vegetables flushing out the contaminants I had unwittingly brought with me. In the intervening decade, I've learned, or rather leaned into that sense of cleansing and renewal, and have walked thousands of miles of old roads and paths across this spit of land. The peninsula itself covers some 4,000 square miles. It is wet, one of the wettest places in Japan, and considered one of the wettest places in the Earth's subtropics, pulling in some 157 inches of average annual rainfall. With that wetness comes a richness of history and ecology. The Kumano area of Ki is written in Japanese characters here, and the original character for Kuma is nook, corner, recess, a recessed space, in other words. The second character, No, is undeveloped or virgin, the wilds. Alan Grappard, the French academic historian and Japanologist, describes such an area as a natural mandala. He calls it a large geographical area endowed with all the qualities of metaphysical space. Walk the peninsula, pay attention, and you'll find yourself floating between worlds. Despite being in the center of Japan, the language of the Ki Peninsula feels thick in the mouth, warbled and formal. It calls to mind a North Carolina drawl. In the middle of a 30-day walk last June, I said hello to an old woman tending her patch, and she replied with the equivalent of, "They done saw a bear over yonder. Watch yourself." Even the ATMs say things like, "Oh, hon, thanks for using me. Now you come round again soon. You hear?" I'm always tempted to take out a few extra bucks just to hear more sweet robotic gab. One of my favorite peninsula villages is simply named Furusoto, or Old Village. It feels timeless, suspended between low mountain passes and facing the ocean, a sort of lost micro-Eden. When I approached, I found hunched elderly women wrapped in floral print smocks picking their way through the small groves of Mekon oranges. Smack in the middle of town, between shrubs and fields, farm machinery, is a public hot spring bath. On a recent walk, a tipsy farmer in the locker room, his head barely reaching my shoulder, kept insisting I was putting my robe on backwards. "No, you ain't got it. It's right over left," he said, growing increasingly irritated. Others in the locker room looked at us and laughed. "Left over right is how women do it," he said. "You ain't a woman, are you?" Well, I was pantsless. For a second, I panicked, thinking I might have had it wrong all these years. A lot of people get more things wrong than you'd think. People sidle up to a Shinto shrine and flash cash, clap twice, then bow, when they were supposed to bow twice, clap twice, and then bow again. Some people even clap at Buddhist temples, which sends the monks into a tongue-ticking tizzy. And this guy, with his axe to grind, wasn't going to get me to do it the manly way, but rather the way of death. The dead are wrapped right atop left. I told the farmer, "All right, buddy, if you do right over left, I'll do the same." He did, so did I, and he took me on a little tour of the town, both of us the walking dead. For me, walking through working villages and towns is the great joy of the Ki Peninsula. Being able to cap a day of strenuous mountain routes with a bath along locals, wacky though they may be sometimes, is never not interesting. The whole experience, however, is one of acute bittersweetness. The countryside of Japan is aging into nothingness, and it's rare to see people under the age of 50 out and about. Many of the old coastal tea estates have been converted to solar farms, vast fields of trees replaced by gleaming black panels. Abandoned homes and gardens abound. Part of the reason I've walked Ki so obsessively in recent years is because I feel palpably the fading of what once was. In Odai, I missed having a cup of coffee at La Mer, a classic Japanese kasaten-style cafe, by just two months. The 80-something-year-old owner left a sign outside, "I've aged out of business." In Tachihara, an inn that has been in operation for hundreds of years may soon take its last border. But these changes don't necessarily induce gloominess or sadness. They're simply part of the inexorable flow of contemporary life. The aging of population mixed with the loss of employment opportunities in the countryside. We've made certain decisions about certain industries on the global scale, and this, in part, is the result. Instead, if I feel anything, it's gratitude toward the energy of the peninsula itself, the abundant vitality of the land, and the kindness of the people who are still there, all buoyed by the 1,000-plus years of historical import. I wish you all of you reading this, could teleport here right now, right in this very moment, and I could take you on a long walk around one of the peninsula's towns on a Sunday morning, all blue skies and sunshine, to bear witness to the pride with which it's all being maintained. Just a few folks left, and yet, streets swept, shop gates lifted, Casatin beacons flashing. One imagines flying carp in the spring and the last of the summer festival shrines carried on the shoulders of shirtless men in white rag fondushi underwear. But you'd have to come now, right now, like a tiny nub of glowing charcoal. This brightness and warmth isn't long for our world. By the way, Craig Maad not only is a writer and photographer, he lives in Kamakura, and you can follow his work on Instagram and Twitter, and his latest book is Kisa Kisa, or Kisa by Kisa, and this chronicles his walking around the Nakasendo Highway from Tokyo to Kyoto, and his next book is going to take place on the place we just visited, the Kii Peninsula. So there you go. You've met a new traveling buddy, right? Well, we continue by resting our feet for a moment, and we're going to head to California, where writer Dina Mischief leads us 22 miles on foot, 10 minutes on a tram, an extraordinary day hike. Now, her article appeared in the March 25th, 2025 issue of the New York Times. So let us go. The steep trail near the top of the Palm Springs aerial tramway was covered in inches of spongy fallen needles and peppered with ankle-twisting pine cones. It was also shady, which felt remarkable after the first 7 miles of the grueling Cactus to Clouds hike, offered more than a brittle brush leaf's worth of relief. I had already hiked up 7,549 vertical feet and still had about 3,000 to go to the top of Mount San Jacinto, a granite crag towering just west of Palm Springs, California. For this, my third Cactus to Clouds hike, I had chosen a mid-November day, and the conditions were perfect. The 22-mile slopes continuously, relentlessly uphill for the first 16 miles, rising from the desert floor to the 10,834-foot summit, then 6 miles, 2,400 vertical feet down, to the top of the tram, culminating in a ride back down that's well worth the $14 ticket. I started my trek near the Palm Springs Art Museum at an elevation of 482 feet just after sunrise at 6:41 a.m., carrying enough water to last the first water until the first water source, which would be a ranger station at 8,400 feet. I had packed several jackets to deal with the wild temperature swings from bottom to top. People have a variety of reasons to attempt Cactus to Clouds. It's one of the most biodiverse day hikes in the country. It's an unusual wilderness experience on the edge of an urban area. But maybe above all, there's the sheer audacity of the hike. In my previous ascents, each following a significant emotional or physical trauma, diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, divorce, completion of treatment for stage 3 breast cancer, I was motivated by the idea that committing myself to this challenge would leave me with little energy to feel sorry for myself. And if I made it, well, that was proof I could handle anything. Well, this time my MS was in remission, my marriage was fulfilling, and I had been cancer-free for almost 9 years. More than 15 years after my first Cactus to Clouds, it was finally about the landscape instead of about me. I had stashed a pocket guide to the plants of the San Jacinto Mountains and planned to take and stop and smell the cedar. While the Cactus to Clouds route is only for the supremely fit, you can also hike sections of it. Walk the bottom mile from the trailhead to a picnic area, then turn around. Or ride the tram to its top station, then climb to Mount San Jacinto's summit and back. You can even trek to the top of the tram, then ride it down, saving the summit for the next day, as I did this time because of sudden foot pain. Each offers payoffs like forever views of the Coachella Valley, and a chance to spot cactus wrens, Cooper's hawks, and golden eagles. Mind-boggling shapes and smells. The landscape changes as you ascend the trail, starting with the Chola cactus at lower elevations, chaparral, scrub oak, and manzanita as you climb higher, then mixed pine forest, and finally open views at the summit. While Mount San Jacinto's elevation is not remarkable, the difference in altitude from the base to the summit is. The mountain rises about 10,400 vertical feet and approximately 6 horizontal miles. This steep incline, aside from being almost the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest, accounts for the unusual variety of plant life as it passes through 4 life zones. The trail begins among desert species like marrow cactus and creosote, followed by chaparral, scrub oak, and manzanita. Then comes a mixed pine forest. At the summit, the trees grow shorter, gnarled by the altitude and the elements, and include timber pine, which flourishes where little else can. The environment and life look very different down in the Colorado Sonoran Desert than at the top of Mount San Jacinto, said Melanie Davis, a lead field botanist with the Center for Conservation Biology at the University of California, Riverside. And that was a few days before I hiked. But it's the in-between zones that are most interesting, she said. That's where there'll be the most biodiversity. Ms. Davis was right. Between 7,000 and 8,000 feet, the color green came in mind-boggling array of shapes, textures, hues, and sizes, with a range of unexpected smells. It was like hiking through a bowl of mixed salad greens, cedar, manzanita, oak, and agave, with Jeffrey pines adding just a hint of butterscotch to the air. Scorching below, frigid above. The conditions that make Cactus the Clouds remarkable also make it dangerous. Hikers in the trail have died from dehydration and exposure. We get about 1 fatality a year, said Eric Holden, a volunteer for Riverside Mountain Rescue, one of 4 research and rescue teams that respond to hikers in distress on the route. To protect both hikers and rescuers, Mount San Jacinto State Park has closed part of the route under its authority in the summer, triple-digit temperatures at the bottom and winter snow and freezing conditions at the top. In 2024, the trail closed in early July and reopened in November 4th. There is little shade for the first 7,000 vertical feet and no water for 10 miles. One of the biggest killers is hikers who started up, realizing they don't have the physical fitness and turnaround, Mr. Holden said. It might have been cooler when they started at 3 in the morning, but now they're not feeling good and hiking down into temperatures that could easily be over 100 degrees. In the winter, snow can make the trail hard to follow, especially in the 1,000 feet below the top of the tram, and hikers have gotten stranded among the cliffs. I stayed on the path in this section by following a GPS track from a previous Cactus to Clouds hike. Backpacker magazine calls Cactus to Clouds the 5th hardest day hike in America. It takes most hikers between 12 and 16 hours. I tried to entertain myself from the unrelenting climb by identifying exactly which species of manzanita was scratching my legs, but that did only so much to distract me. I sat down to rest on a flat boulder 6,000 feet above the trailhead next to what was either a pink bracted or greenleaf manzanita. At least I was hiking uphill. Most seasoned hikers understand that while ascending is hard work, going downhill is downright punishing. Cactus to Clouds, in fact, came to exist only because much of the descent takes place on the tram. We were dedicated hikers and always looking for a challenge, said Sue Birnbaum, one of the 6 members of the Coachella Valley Hiking Club who first completed the annual Cactus to Clouds challenge in 1993. But it wouldn't have happened if it required hiking all the way down. That challenge, an extraordinary super day hike, linked 3 existing trails, the Museum, Skyline, and the Mount San Jacinto Peak Trails, crossing a mixture of local, state, and federal lands and property owned by the Agua Caliente Indian Reservation, with the tram, which has been operating since 1963. Now, the mountain is part of the traditional homeland of the Coahuila Nation. On top of the world. One paradox of Cactus to Clouds, it's better when there are no clouds. They obscure the views and sometimes the trail itself. This ascent also held a different kind of paradox for me. It was the first time I had ever hiked the summit trail separately. Yet I felt a surge of pride because I had listened to my body and spared my sore foot. Against the panorama of the Pacific Ocean, the shimmering Salton Sea, and the snaggly sacred Keats Peak. Magnificent cauliflower-shaped clouds floated thousands of feet below. With sunset about 90 minutes away, they caught and reflected shades that you would ordinarily see in a scoop of mango ice cream. Despite the warm oranges radiating across the sky, the summit was freezing with buffeting wind gusts. I was bundled up in three jackets, including a hooded, down, puffy coat, and would have gladly accepted another. So as much as I wanted to linger, I wanted even more to avoid frostbite. I hopped back through the boulders to the trail and pointed myself downhill to the tram, crossing through a cluster of what I identified as bush chinkapin. My pocket guide said its fruit tastes like chestnuts. Well, next time I do Cactus to Clouds, I'm sure to stop and give them a try. That was quite an ordeal for that person, huh? My goodness. Well, let's continue our walk as we leave California, and we're going to head east to take a walk through the past in New York. Yep, the Big Apple. Writer Russell Shorto prepared this article ahead of the 2024 celebration of the 400th anniversary of the Dutch colony of New Netherland. Now, it appeared in the June 19, 2023 issue of the New York Times. Shorto's a historian and offers a walking tour of often overlooked Native American and black sites found in Manhattan. So let's learn more about this. And by the way, Shorto has a book called The Island at the Center of the World, and he directs the New Amsterdam Project at the New York Historical Society, and he's now working on a book about early Manhattan. So now here's his article. In the 19 years since my book, The Island at the Center of the World, about the Dutch settlement that preceded New York came out, I've changed the way I think about the history and geography of New Amsterdam, which occupied the southern tip of Manhattan Island in the 1600s. In recent years, as the culpability of our forebears has come into focus, I've come to see the Dutch period as comprising three constituencies: the European settlement, which was only about half Dutch, the Native Americans, who were steadily displaced yet remained a force, and the enslaved Africans, who were brought here against their will but employed agency and ingenuity to their situation. In preparation for 2024's 400th anniversary of the Dutch colony, I hit the streets as I put together a walking tour to tell the complex story of New York's beginnings. Now, this is a story of settlement, conquest, peace, strife, promise, prosperity, enslavement, and freedom. And here's how you can follow. And he takes the rest of the time to kind of give us tips on this tour. First, Battery Park. The obvious start of such a tour is at the tip of Battery Park, looking into the harbor. The Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island speak to the city's ideals of freedom and promise, and its long relationship with the water, from clipper ships to World War II battleships to commuter ferries. But in my mind's eye, I see the waterscape incised by silent canoes. Several groups of Munsee people inhabited the wider region for centuries, a homeland stretching from Connecticut through New York and New Jersey to Delaware, and moved seasonally from the mainland to the island they called Manhattan, which translates roughly as a place of wood for making bows, to fish and hunt. I envision, too, Henry Hudson's small wooden sailing vessel, the Half Moon, appearing on the horizon in September 1609 as he charted the area for the Dutch, setting in motion a historic transformation. Then in 1624, another Dutch vessel arrived, bearing the first settlers of the colony of New Netherland. Cross Battery Park, which is also all landfill, and you come to the original shoreline of Manhattan. The plaza in front of the Alexander Hamilton U.S. Custom House is probably where, in 1626, Dutch settlers under the command of Peter Minuit made the infamous purchase of the island from a branch of the Munsee. What each side thought was going on in this exchange is an interesting question. The Dutch knew that the Native Americans had no notion of property transfer. Both sides believed they were entering into a defensive pact. Neither could know what the coming centuries would bring, but it can't be denied that the event was a milestone in the dispossession of Native Americans from their land. The Custom House, which was built in 1907 from a design by the architect Cass Gilbert, occupies the site of Fort Amsterdam, the bulwark that protected New Amsterdam. By a curious coincidence, it happens to be the home of the National Museum of the American Indian, whose permanent exhibition, Native New York, offers a primer on the indigenous groups who have called the New York State region home, from the Ukachug and other tribes of pre-contact Long Island to the Mohawk iron workers who helped build 20th century skyscrapers. The Muncie surely had in mind a working relationship with the Dutch, who came initially to trade furs. That trade continued throughout the lifetime of the colony, but the Dutch soon shifted their attention northward, where the Mohawk, who lived along the river of the same name, had a more plentiful supply of beavers. The relationship suffered its first serious blow when Willem Kieft, a director of New Netherland, declared war on the Muncie in 1643. In attacking his colony's business partners, Kieft acted against the wishes of his own people, and the war inflicted terrible losses on both sides. Even greater suffering came to the Native Americans as a result of smallpox, which the Europeans brought unwittingly. That said, the Muncie are very much alive today. Through myriad treaties and swindles, they were split apart, and many were relocated or simply moved to Oklahoma, Kansas, Delaware, and Ontario. Others never went anywhere. We're still here, 30 miles from where all those years ago. Micheline Picarol, a member of the Turtle Clan of the Rompopo Muncie Lenape in Andover, New Jersey, told me. She and her husband, Chief Vincent Mann, run a farm and serve as advocates for their community. Head down Whitehall to Pearl Street. Lower Manhattan is enveloped by several blocks of landfill. I find it useful to walk the original shoreline, which on the east was Pearl Street. The section was on either side of Whitehall Street, contained the first Dutch houses erected in the 1620s. On the west side of the street, a row of them overlooked the East River in the wilds, what would later become the village of Brooklyn. Now, in one of these lived Catalina Trico and her husband, Horace Repella, a couple of nobodies from present-day Belgium who showed up in Amsterdam as immigrants, seeking work, heard of this new venture. They got married, jumped on one of the first ships, and made their lives here. They would have 11 children, 10 of whom lived to marry and have children of their own. Their descendants today number in the millions. I think of them as the Adam and Eve of New Amsterdam. Now, at the corner of Pearl and Coenties Street, or Slip, I should say, an outline in gray stones on the wide sidewalk marks the foundation of a building that started life as the Staatsherberg, or City Tavern. Ships arriving from Europe would anchor in the East River, then passengers were rowed to a nearby dock. Apparently, the first thing everybody wanted to do after 10 or 12 weeks at sea, have a drink, and this became a very popular spot. It stood to reason, then, that when the city won a municipal charter in 1653, the same building would be converted into Manhattan's first city hall. New Amsterdam's twin burgomasters, or mayors, would hold sessions with their council, resolving disputes and managing their city. And you continue to the corner of Pearl and Wall Streets, we come to the site of one of the most far-reaching achievements of that council. Stop and face south. You're at the northeast corner of the city. And to your left, imagine the East River lapping at your feet. To your right, it's not hard to envision the legendary wall running down the middle of the street. The wall, actually more of a fence made of planks, was built in the wake of the municipal charter when the city government took measures to defend the place against an expected attack from the English. And it's no accident that global finance is associated with that wall and this street. And there, my friends, is where we end today's Journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope that you've enjoyed it and you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.